Welcome back to The Daily Drum on WHUR, Sirius XM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2 and 98.3 FM. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher.
We can't and we won't tolerate these types of threats or messages that disrupt or create fear in our communities. Let me be very clear. The students responsible are going to face some serious consequences.
That was Frederick County Sheriff Chuck Jenkins last week after 3 8th graders at Middletown Middle School in Frederick County were charged with hate crimes. They posted video threats of deadly violence against black students on social media. One of the three boys also facing a gun charge. This incident has frightened and galvanized students and parents in Frederick County, but it still raises a lot of questions about racism and how we view race in school. We're examining these issues tonight. My guests are Dr. Eric Lewis Phillips. He is the Executive Director of Public Affairs for the Frederick County Public School System. Also, Dr. Jeff Menzie. He is a clinical psychology scholar. Lines are open if you want to get in on this conversation at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. I invite you to tweet me at HFisherWHUR or find me on Instagram at Harold Fisher, Harold T. Fisher. Dr. Phillips, thank you so much for joining the conversation. We appreciate you sharing some time with us this evening.
Well, thank you for having me.
Okay. And Jeff, good to have you on the program as always. I guess the thing I really am curious about, this obviously happened last week. At last report, the last big issue was this huge protest against hate crimes and racism. But where do you think the county school system is right now? How would you characterize how parents are feeling in the wake of this incident?
It's definitely very disheartening. I think it's definitely given people pause to think about what we do as far as the conversations we have with students, how comfortable parents are having conversations, and how comfortable our staff is with having conversations with students related to discriminatory speech, racial slurs, expressions of hate towards others because of who they are as individuals or how they identify as a group. So I think right now, as a community, you mentioned that we're galvanized, and we see that happening within the community as far as coming together to speak out against such acts. So I would say overall what it's done is caused individuals within Frederick County and within Frederick County Public Schools to speak out against acts such as the ones that were depicted in language, such as what was written in the post that came to light last week.
Mm-hmm. How do you believe it got to the point of racial threats? Do you have, I know we can't identify these juveniles, but how would you characterize the backstory of this? Do you believe that this was something that was simmering beneath the surface? Were you surprised? Your thoughts about that?
But yeah, I mean, I don't have the backstory as far as what ignited this and what was happening with our students prior to this. But I would say a part of that question is as a community, as a society, meaningful, real conversations about race and racism are typically difficult for individuals to have, especially in company with individuals whom they may not identify with race or ethnically. So I would say one of the things that we've always done in Frederick County for several years now is work with staff about how we have conversations, critical topics, important topics such as race, sexism, ageism, all the isms for that matter, bias, implicit bias. So those conversations have been had. But when we think about race and when we think about racism specifically, it is something that is so ingrained in our society. And so our students are being informed not just by what they're learning in schools, but they're also informed by what happens before they even enter the schoolhouse, before they enter the classroom. And so I can't say what our students were exposed to that led up to them posting these images. But what I will say is a lot of the work in the school system is to combat against those types of things from happening. But we have other forces that we're fighting against to make sure that our students understand the severity of such remarks, whether it's a racial slur mm-hmm. toward another student or an act that shows hate or harm toward others.
Mm. You just said that even prior to this, that there have been, you know, conversations about racial issues and, as part of, I'm assuming, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, as an attempt to, you know, promote racial understanding. Can you drill down a little bit more? What are those conversations like? How are they held? Is this in class? Is it during PTA? Is it with... Explain that if you can.
Sure, not a problem. I think one of the places that takes place is in the classroom when we look at our curriculum and our instruction. So, for example, in social studies, you'll find that there is a concerted effort to make sure that we're addressing topics in history that haven't typically been presented, and we're presenting those topics or those moments in our history from multiple historical perspectives and views. When I was growing up, multiple perspectives and views about a moment in history, those different viewpoints weren't always shared. It was shared from a very Eurocentric viewpoint. So we especially want the viewpoints of people of color, women, or those who identify as members of the LGBTQI+ community. We want those perspectives to be shared when we're looking at certain moments throughout our history. Providing those multiple perspectives, it creates a richer account of our American and world history, and it allows teachers to be able to dive deep into the inequities and the historical marginalization of groups of people. And in those conversations, you can have rich dialogue about situations that have been ignited because of racism or sexism or any of the other isms that have historically marginalized groups of people. And it's really important that our teachers, one of the things we work on is preparing them to be able to facilitate such conversations. We have a guidebook with protocol for teachers to use so that if the conversation is something that's part of the curriculum, there's proper onboarding of students to be prepared for such topics. Oftentimes, it may not be part of the discussion for that day. An art teacher can have something planned for the day and something happens in the community, and that teacher also needs to be prepared to facilitate meaningful conversation. And so the other piece of that is making sure that our teachers have the knowledge and the skill set to be able to do that. If I told you that all of them do, that wouldn't be truthful. It's a process. People are at different points and different places with being able to have these conversations. So it requires continuous work with all of our teachers, no matter what they teach, to be prepared to have that.
Mm. Before
yeah, part of your question. I'm sorry.
Before I bring Dr. Menzi in, I did want to kind of piggyback on what you just shared. You certainly do understand that in school systems across our region, indeed across the country, there has been a great deal of pushback on multicultural historical perspectives, particularly when it relates to people of color. Some people would call that CRT. It has been a political hot table. As we know, there are no school districts in this region at all, including yours, that is teaching, of course, that which would be considered CRT. But I'm quite sure that just based on your quite detailed description, that some parents who are not parents of color would disagree. And how do you teach those difficult stories about, for example, we're talking about black people because that was at the heart of these charges, hate crimes against black students. So how do you teach that? How do you inject that into the Frederick County school system without parents raising all kind of hell about it, as we've seen in Northern Virginia?
Right. Well, number one, you can't water down the history. The history is the history. So it's teaching the facts of what happened, providing multiple perspectives from different people from that time period. And, you know, there's this saying, you know, you don't want to repeat the mistakes of the past. Well, if you don't want to repeat those mistakes, then you have to know what happened in the past. So we have to teach the facts of what happened in the past, and our teachers have to be prepared to do that in a way that does not show bias. That they're not injecting their own opinions or thoughts, but we're presenting what actually happened. We're, again, providing multiple perspectives from that time period, and we're allowing students to draw their own conclusions, helping them to appreciate the importance of civil discourse and what that means and what that looks like, how to gather accurate facts. One of the things that I always talk about with teachers is we want our kids to be connoisseurs of information. So before you just spoon-feed yourself information, you want to make sure you stop that spoon and you take a critical look at it and really analyze, where is this coming from? What opinions are being injected into this information? Is it accurate? Is it not accurate? And again, helping students to arrive at the thoughts and their ideas about what happened in the past and being able to facilitate a meaningful dialogue about that history. And then helping them to appreciate, so this is what happened in the past. How do we prevent that from happening now?
Let me go to Dr. Jeff. We are talking about the 3 8th graders at Middletown Middle School in Frederick County, Maryland. Last week, they were charged with hate crimes after posting deadly violence threats against black students on social media. If you have a comment, if you have a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Jeff, I'd like for you, if you could, you know, talk to us about, you know, the mindset of you know, young teenagers. These were threats that were made on social media. They were frightening to everyone. Is this kind of something that, obviously, beyond the legal piece, the criminal piece, that needs to be nipped in the bud before we see these, you know, students who get older and may carry out some of these threats?
Thanks, Harold, for the invitation and the opportunity
sure.
to speak on this topic. Very important for us to, I think, simultaneously address the inherent racism and violence within, you know, these middle schoolers and the population that they represent, because it's not just these three kids. These are the three kids who did what we're talking about right now. They're far from the only ones that believe this way and have thoughts along these lines. I think that, one, we should address that, but simultaneously also talk to those children whose lives are being threatened and to help them to be better prepared to protect themselves by way of situational awareness, understanding what to do should they show up and try to carry these threats out, and also to understand, you know, what a lot of the white children that we're talking about, I'm pretty sure they had firearms training. They've gone to gun shows. I've been to gun shows, Harold, and I see young white children, 10 years old, 9 years old, 13 years old, 15, 16 years old, picking up and handling weapons with their parents, and they're holding the guns properly, which lets me know that they've been trained on these things. And I think that we as black people or people of color, we shy away largely, generally speaking, from this level of preparation and understanding gun safety and mature and proper gun handling. But I think that that's a conversation that we need to have, because our children need to be able to protect themselves. And I think part of the reason why we shy away from that conversation is because of the negative stereotypical imagery that's given of black people with guns as being thugs or gangsters or just community-based threats, as opposed to people who are willing and able to protect themselves or defend themselves at all costs.
But what about the mindset of the children, even outside of that, about, you know, the old saying, racism is as American as apple pie. Mm-hmm. And these young children obviously didn't just show up one day and decide to say racist things.
Right, right. Yeah, and on that point, Harold, it's socialized. And that was one thing I wanted to actually bring up. I'm glad you did it. Is that it's not just an intellectual thing to where we're going to be able to teach them certain things within a classroom setting, and it's going to reverse this attitude, this beliefs, and these behaviors that are actually socialized in these children. They come from families, more likely than not, and if not families, communities. And if not necessarily community, they might have a peer or social group that is influencing them and embedding this deep ideology into them to where they will openly offer these threats against black children specifically, and also demonstrate that they have the means to carry it out. So this is a socialization issue. It's not an intellectual or information-based issue at all.
I need to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to go to the phones. We're going to talk to Walter calling from D.C. We're going to talk to Tennille calling from Frederick. So if you are on the line, please do not hang up. You will be able to hear the program. Lines are still open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We will continue to take phone calls all the way up until 8 o'clock. So don't forget, you can hear every edition of the Daily Drum Inside segment via podcast on WHUR.com, posted every night after 8:30. Also, download the 96.3 HD2 app on your smartphone and hear the program live in its entirety. Stay with us. I'm Harold Fisher. John Mons is next with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR. This conversation continues on SiriusXM in a few seconds. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on SiriusXM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight, we are talking about race and racism after three eighth graders in Frederick County were charged with hate crimes. These three students from Middletown Middle School. They posted video threats against black students on social media. And my guests tonight are Dr. Eric Lewers Phillips, Executive Director of Public Affairs for the Frederick County Public Schools. Also, Dr. Jeff Menzie. He's a clinical psychology scholar. If you have questions or comments, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Walter, thanks for hanging on. What's on your mind?
Okay. I got three things, but I'm going to have to hurry up. Number one, Jesse Smollett. He was accused of hate crime, saying that two Trump supporters attacked him. And basically, he lied, and the judge gave him a tongue lashing, and he had to do 150 days in jail directly. And we saw he almost had a heart attack. Number two, we're talking about Glenn Youngkin and Winston Sears, the lieutenant governor, who won the election because of critical race theory. As a black woman, Winston Sears is a black nationalist or a black hater because she is like a foreigner who just hates black people, period. And number three, Larry Elder. Remember Larry Elder said that he's the black face of white supremacy? Well, I guess Winston Sears is going to take that position. So does Candace Owens, who used race as reverse racism. There are people out there who talks about, oh, black people don't need respiration, but they're elders.
So, Walter, what does this have to do with what we're talking about regarding the incident last week at Frederick?
Well, I will say this. If young people listen to those kind of people, they'll be just like the Klan and the neo-Nazis.
I don't know this for a fact. I suspect that these three young suspects, all of whom are white, probably did not. But thank you so much for your input. Let me go to Tennille. Tennille, calling from Frederick. Tennille, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, you know, I want to say as a Frederick resident, you know, I think the biggest issue that we have right now is that area of Frederick County and other areas of Frederick County don't want to acknowledge the embedded racism within the county. And that is holstered in many incidences and many occasions by a police department that is sometimes tone deaf. And even in its reaction to this incident, some of their posts, their community posts, their other things, have been exactly that. They've been tone deaf. Now, they have shown some efforts, and I don't know how aesthetic those are, but they have shown some efforts recently to improve the diversity in the area. But if we don't continue to see the leadership and everything, trying to appease or appeal to one of the largest, if not the largest city in Maryland, and the onset and ongoing diversity up here, if we don't have leadership that is here for everybody, we are going to continue to have these kind of incidences. Yet again today, there is another incident at Middletown, and we don't know what it is. 2 years ago, almost 3 years ago, we had an incident where young juveniles were involved with the assault of a white man at a fair. I mean, this is going to erupt into you know, just a continuously volcanic type of atmosphere if people don't get out there and say right is right and wrong is wrong. And in Middletown, a lot of people say, no, this isn't a racist town. This is a racist country. And if you don't start to try and make changes, and everybody wants to sweep all of these discussions under the rug, we are going to continue to have these kind of issues. And we can't afford it because, like I said, this is an increasingly diverse place.
Tenille, if I may ask you, how would you characterize the sheriff's response to last week's incident?
I mean, I can appreciate that there isn't these kids got a smack on the hand, and that there has been, you know, some charges filed, but that is a community outcry, and this county needs to recognize the community as a whole. There are certain people, and I have been involved in the dialogue, whether they are black, white, Asian, whatever they are, blue, purple, whoever, that don't approve of racism. They just don't. You know, there is a huge dynamic of biracial children in this area. And so, you know, some people are tired of it. But the majority, there is still, with the political distress and everything else that's going on, they got a lot of work to do in that police department.
Okay.
They really do.
If you could, you know, Dr. Phillips, she said quite a bit, particularly as it relates to what was, you know, happening, you know, in Frederick. But your thoughts about the response to last week, and also what she's saying about dealing with issues of race in that community. Because one of the things you did say that struck me last week during the press conference was that some parents have decided to go back to virtual learning after this incident. And that, I thought that was a remarkable thing.
Yeah, so I appreciate your comments. And I can just speak from, again, the school system standpoint as far as last week's situation. Typically, whenever a threat is made, a triage team is brought together right away. And it's made up of a minimum of three individuals, a school principal, a counselor, or a school psychologist, and then the school resource officer. And that's what took place last Wednesday, mid-morning around, when this was first brought to light to school administration and the our resource officer. And once that takes place, an assessment is made of the threat. So I would say from Wednesday morning till Thursday, between that time and Thursday morning, by the time we got to noon on Thursday, the state attorney's office had enough information to press charges against the students. The sheriff's office was part of that team the entire time. So at no point during from the triage to the threat assessment to charges being pressed, at no time was there any lax on their end from investigating the situation. Now, I can't speak to other individuals' experience or work with law enforcement agencies, but as a school system, whenever a threat is made, law enforcement is always first at the scene. Now, other instances across the county when these types of things happen outside of the school system, I can't speak to that because I don't have that firsthand knowledge. But I can't speak to the swiftness with which the investigation was conducted. Students were brought in with their parents or guardians for interviews, and they were able to give enough evidence to the state attorney's office to press charges last week. And because it is still an open investigation, there's a lot that I can't share. The other piece of what I appreciate that Tenille shared was the fact that she alluded to and stated that it's a community issue. So, and she mentioned that racism is something that is across the nation. It's not synonymous with Frederick County or Middletown. One of the things that we will often hear as a school system is Frederick County Public Schools needs to stop racism. Well, public schools are part of a larger system. We are a system that's part of a larger system. So racism enters our doors. On day five of school, we don't open up textbooks and say, we're going to teach you how to be this, fill in the blank today. It's one of the things that we have to address and combat vigorously, because it is so embedded in our society. So it really does take a community coming together to address this. The school system has to do its part. There's work that we have done. There's work that we are doing. And there's more work that we need to do to improve. Mm-hmm. And we know that. But it's also something that has to be done in concert with the community. all the other structures that make up our community need to have a part in this, need to speak out against it, because it is something that is pervasive throughout our society.
Tenille, thank you so much for your input. We appreciate your phone call. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We're talking about race and racism in school on the heels of 3 8th graders at Middletown Middle School in Frederick County charged with hate crimes last week. Jeff, I'm curious to hear your take on, you know, just from an educational standpoint, how do you address race and racism in school when, as I said earlier in the program, when there's so many school systems that are just giving pushback for anything that may make white people, for example, feel uncomfortable. So suffice it to say, when you're talking about history and the difficult history of race and enslaved people in this country, there are a whole lot of black people, me included, who find that difficult to hear, but still necessary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, Harold, the fact that white parents can push back against the teaching of fact-based history that's race-related or deals with racism is itself an example of racism and white supremacy in this nation. And so I would start by pointing it out just like that, that this is the example of racism in this country, the fact that you all can stop people from teaching factual history just because it paints white people into a negative light, but it's fact-based and it's true history. And so, you know, that's how deep this game goes, Harold. And so one of the things I know that helps this process out is, you know, more than just the intellectual treatment of the topic, but actual deeply moving, psychologically transforming, you know, because some people package it under diversity, equity, and inclusion work. And, you know, I've done plenty of these trainings with school systems, with individual teachers, help to rewrite curricula. I actually do a presentation called Assault with the Deadly Curriculum. And a part of that is to show how, even when we're doing the intellectual treatment of history, we oftentimes start with enslavement, or we start with the history of African Americans or Africans, period, when they're reacting to European oppression. So it starts off telling the whole population of people that their people only exist to respond to the presence of white people. And so, you know, when you get that level of insight and you take people through that emotionally unpacking process to where they can talk about how their grandfather taught them to be racist when they were little, and they can talk about how they do call black people the N-word when black people aren't around, when you give people the safe space to really process these things, to unpack it, to see how ugly this stuff really is and how they perpetuate it, then and only then can you start the transformation. Other than that, like you said, they're going to avoid being discomfort. They're going to avoid the discomfort, which is a natural human, a healthy human process. You want to avoid being uncomfortable. But you put them in a space to where it's less comfortable to stay the same than it would be to go through that change. That's what we need to do.
Please go right ahead.
I'm the former equity supervisor for Frederick County Public Schools as well, and a large part of the document says there is the work that we engage in as a school system. I mean, it's a lot of inside-out reflection. So one of the things we ask staff members to do is really reflect on, first of all, who are you as an individual? What are all the things that make you who you are, those experiences, your background, the ways that you identify? All those things inform how you interact in diverse settings. And so that deep work, which is one of the reasons why we continue to see the issues that we see today, is because individuals have to be willing to take that deep dive into why is it that I view individuals, groups, situations the way that I do? Where does that come from? And helping to guide people through that process in a safe space is important. One of the questions I typically, or one of the statements I'll typically make to my colleagues and to parents that I am able to speak with is, unless you were there at the table when the construct of race was created, and you were at the table when you decided to marginalize groups of people because of their color, then the feelings of guilt, although you may have them, the guilt should come if you choose to continue to perpetuate that mindset and that way of thinking. We have to be able to get past the fear that we may have of being uncomfortable in those conversations. When I say get past, it's a process. It doesn't happen overnight for folks. People function after a life of experience and background and perspective, and it takes time for people to overturn those things. But the key is that it has to be a work that is continuous, and it's not an easy work. So when we think about what's happening with the adults in our schools and the adults in our community, if the willingness is not there to do that difficult work, then we'll unfortunately continue to see situations like this and others, not just here, but across the country.
Let me challenge you on that, though, Dr. Phillips, because that argument, as well put together as it is, if you were to reverse that, I can imagine that someone would say the same thing to a black person who would say, well, if you weren't there when your forefathers and foremothers were enslaved. And, you see what I'm saying? And so what is the argument if someone were to try to turn that around on its head?
Yeah, I appreciate that pushback. The thing is, we all are informed by our past, and mm-hmm. we can't get away from that. But the difference here is oftentimes there are individuals that want to shut down the conversation about race and racism in the society in which we live in because of that guilt they feel, that privilege. When the word privilege is brought out there, people turn away from the conversation. So it's helping them to understand that, while those feelings of guilt may be there, that guilt can drown you and cause you not to want to engage in a meaningful conversation to get to a better space or a better place. It can be turned around. Any argument that you present can be turned around. but I think for the work that we do in Frederick County is staying the course and making sure that we work with people so that there's no easy out from getting out of that meaningful conversation.
If I can address that as well.
Sure, go right ahead.
One of the things about turning that around in that way, the main difference is that there is a system that has been established on the mistreatment of black people by white people that give white people a consistent and constant advantage since that time. That's the main difference here. And so we didn't have to be there during that time, but the system itself was established during that time, and it maintains itself to this very day. And so we're still being subjected to not only the residual, but the ongoing and very much present oppression of non-white people by white people who practice racism and white supremacy. But there's really no comparison in the two. People use it as an intellectual joust. They try to slip the jab with that, but it's futile. It's a futile attempt. It doesn't work.
Let me go back to the phone lines, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Mike, calling from Baltimore. Thanks for calling, Mike. What's on your mind?
Yeah, thanks. I mean, if we look at this thing from a psychosocial historical perspective and culture, Frederick County is the home, it's the historical home of the Ku Klux Klan. It's the home of the Grand Wizard. And then we're dealing with a whole thing of different issues here with the we're talking about the Appalachian region of the country. This is the Appalachians. There's a whole different culture there. And what I've been noticing about areas like Frederick County and some of these other more Western Maryland counties is that we're beginning to see over, let's say, maybe a short period of maybe 20, we're seeing an explosion of suburban and urban development emerging on that area of the state of Western Maryland. It's a totally different culture there. So what I'm seeing in this issue about racism, why are we surprised that some of this would be happening here?
Well, we may not be surprised, disappointed, angered, in some cases.
And I don't know why I'm getting this noise, but I'm getting a lot of feedback.
Well, we can hear you perfectly. I can't say, but I appreciate your phone call nevertheless, Mike. I did want to ask, if I could, Dr. Phillips, why didn't the acting superintendent speak at the press conference last week?
That was on me. I didn't think it was appropriate to have and I made this statement, a group of white men having this conversation. As a spokesperson for the school system, it was appropriate that I give the remarks. But there were questions that were asked at the press conference that a white individual can't answer. For example, one of the questions was, how are black families doing in the community? And sometimes what happens in those situations is they can't answer, everybody is safe. Well, physically, maybe. Psychologically, no. Emotionally, no. The hurt is still there. So those things have to be addressed. Our interim superintendent, Dr. Marco, did send a message to the community that evening, and that was, he'd already planned to do that. But for the press conference, it is my role for the school system to make comments related to that, and he was there standing with us as we did that.
So here's my concern about that, because he is the superintendent of the entire school system, not just the white folks. It seems to me, because you know down here in the good old close-knit DMV, whether it's Prince George's County or Montgomery County or Charles County, we have superintendents who speak to these very critical issues, whatever they happen to be, race, budget, violence, whatever it happens to be. And I'll be quite honest with you, that kind of gives me pause, because if the head of the school system is unable to handle an issue such as this, why would he want the job?
So he's definitely able to handle it. He didn't speak based off of my direction. And he's been at the school, and he definitely has been there to support students and families since the incident. He's called staff members throughout the county and things like that related to this. So, again, he followed my direction on that. And in hindsight, after that was over, what you're sharing with me has been part of the discussion.
Yeah. Which is not, hold on for a minute, Jeff. I'll let you have a word. Which is not to say, Dr. Phillips, that I, from an observational point, that you did not do an excellent job. I think you did, and I think you also provided context and nuance in all of these things. And so certainly I salute your intellect and your care and concern at the press conference. But I still think that, even with that said, that the head of any huge organization that has people from all backgrounds, and as you said, this is obviously part of the discussion, that they would be able to handle that. But Jeff, go right ahead.
All right. And so it's a lot of things in that decision and the way that this was carried out. You know, and again, nothing directed towards you, good doctor. I understand in tough times we got to make tough calls and tough decisions, and everybody's not going to agree and like it. I totally understand and respect that position, because it's not an easy one to have. With that being stated, I understand that oftentimes in these types of situations, we don't allow the white people to come forward and to account for the things that are needing to be accounted for. And so, for example, I understand that the types of questions that came up were questions that may have been more fit for a black person to respond to. But then there could be questions fit for a white person to respond to, such as, why do you think this racism exists in this county and it's so deep? What are your personal views on racism as they exist? You, as a white person, have you ever experienced racism? Have you ever been the perpetuator of it or seen somebody perpetuated it? And how did you respond? We give that's a perfect opportunity for black people to hear directly from white people about their perspective of racism, especially when white people are in positions of power. And all too often, we've been trained for centuries now to protect them and their feelings and not allow them to be uncomfortable in these situations. And what I've come to learn is that they need to be on the hot seat when it comes to situations like this. There are plenty of questions that they need to be answering about racism as it relates to young white boys in his community. As an older white boy, as a white man, you see what I'm saying? These are the things that we need to hear. That's what's going to really help us as black people. But we get caught up all too often, many times, talking about our emotions and how hurt we are. We protest, we sing, we hold signs, and then it blows over, and there's never anything resolved, and everybody goes on business as usual. That's problematic.
I don't disagree with that at all. And one of the messages that I've given, being placed in various positions during my time, is that it can't just be the role of those who identify as members of historically marginalized groups to be the spokespeople for their group. And so with this particular incident, there are town halls that are being planned for this. And at those, our interim superintendent will speak and other school officials will speak, because that is important. in that moment last week, as you stated, I made the call and did that for the school system. But yeah, there are, we have to, and you know, I work in a school system where, you know, we're continuing to work to diversify. And so one of the, again, as I shared, one of the comments that I typically share with individuals is that you cannot make a student who identifies as a member of a historically marginalized group, you can't make them the spokesperson for that group. There's a weight that's associated with that, an emotional weight, a physical weight, a mental weight that's associated with all of that. So it requires all of us being able to stand up and say the thing that needs to be said when it comes to incidents such as the one that took place last week.
Amen to that. One of the things, more broadly, you know, Dr. Phillips, we have seen recently, we can call them miscalculations, mistakes, stupidity, where, for example, on social media, in a small town in Louisiana, there was a white male student throwing cotton and then using his belt to whip, you know, another student. I would almost say you can't get any more racist than that until you look at the story coming out of Chatham, North Carolina, where in an exercise in class, you had white students holding a slave auction and selling black students. This, and there were teachers and staff members who were there. And I know these are, you know, are small towns, but I think there's no excuse. But it just makes me wonder, what are people thinking, or they aren't thinking, and how do we get beyond that? You know, like a dear friend of mine used to say, "Don't be sorry, be careful." How can the Frederick County school system be careful so that they are not put in a position of saying we're sorry?
Right. So I think number one, those types of lessons are not part of our curriculum or instructional materials. You should never put a child in a situation where they're reenacting something from the past that did harm. That's not appropriate at all. And a large part of that, when that happens, is there is a gross lack of awareness as far as the impact of such situations on children or adults, for that matter. You know, I wish I could say that we would never have to say I'm sorry or I apologize again. Because of the society in which we live and because of the influences that are on all of us, there may be something that happens that there is a misstep, and we're going to have to say that was completely inappropriate, it did harm, and that we may have to apologize. But I think part of the work that we do is to, along with the education we provide our students, is the education we provide our staff. And that self-awareness. For example, while we're not doing reenactments in our classrooms, no teacher should stand up if they're about to read a piece of historical fiction or they're going over a historical document, and they shouldn't say the N-word. It's not appropriate. It's never appropriate. Before exposing the students to that word in text, there should be some onboarding, and there should be some discussion about why the word is not going to be said. It's talking to our white students, but also our black students. We have some of our black students give their white classmates a license to use the word. Mm. Not appropriate. Nobody should be giving anybody a license to use any racial slurs or derogatory speech. So it's continuing to have those conversations. And again, it can't be a conversation that we have at the beginning of the year when teachers come back, and then we don't revisit it again until the following August when they're back. It has to be a continuous conversation. And so I think, you know, there is that... you know, that consistent message that has to be sent, not just from school system leadership, but from school leadership down to the classroom, and then doing that in conjunction with our parents and our families. And it can't just come from individuals who identify as members of historically marginalized groups. It has to be a message that's delivered by everyone.
Yeah. Well, I must say, again, from what I saw in the press conference, Dr. Phillips, you handled yourself with grace, and we certainly salute that. But I will also say you have your work cut out for you. So I sincerely say to you, good luck as you move through this difficult time in Frederick County. Well, thank you, Dr. Eric Luares Phillips and Dr. Jeff Menzi. We appreciate you talking to us about this really important topic.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the invite.
Sure. That is the Daily Drum for this Tuesday, March 15th. I'm Harold Fisher. Good night.